Hello.
Hi, how are you?
And I just love your classes. They make me crazy, the intellectual stimulation. So I really needed to go back and re-listen to the last 10 minutes because everything got jammed into from Rabbi this, and how we arrive at a conclusion. Fabulous.
I'm so glad.
Fascinating. I don't think I'm on your regular link, though, to get some of
Oh.
to get your tape classes. I mean, I could, this is recorded, right?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to add my name in the chat to make sure you can add me to your mail list. Thanks.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm just gonna wait another just wait another minute before we start for people to get on. Welcome everyone. It's nice to be with you again virtually at least. Hope everybody is healthy and well. As we've been doing for the past few weeks, I'm going to mute everybody for now. And then if people have questions or comments, you can either use the chat box, or if you'd like, you can definitely or if you like, you can definitely unmute at the end of the shiur, at the end of the class, and I'd be happy to take any questions or comments. So once again, welcome everybody back. We're continuing with our class in preparation for Shavuos. Shavuos, as we know, is the day where we received the Torah. We received the Torah on Mount Sinai 49 days after we left Mitzrayim, after we left Egypt. But as we said last week, in addition to receiving the Torah, Shavuos was also the point where we became a nation. We stopped being merely B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, but through the Torah, we became Am Yisrael. We became a nation of Yisrael. We joined together. The Torah is the unifying factor of both our religious and national identity. And so through that, we also became a nation. So in preparation for Shavuos, I want to talk about essentially what it means to be part of the Jewish nation. And a large component of that is conversion, of joining and being part of the Jewish people. So last week, we spoke about one case study, one historical example started around the 1850s and continued through the founding of the State of Israel, about the B'nai Israel people from India. We talked about how they wanted to become part of the mainstream Jewish people, and one of the hurdles that the halachic community needed to deal with was whether they had potentially not had a proper divorce procedure, and whether that precluded them from marrying into the mainstream Jewish population. And we spoke about how the halachic community, especially Rav Herzog, dealt with that. We ended off with a much more fundamental question, which was, how do we know that they are Jewish? And what we answered was, we don't have proof. We don't have historical records. What we do know is that everybody had been calling them the Jewish people for over 1,000 years. Second of all, we finished this year by quoting a genetic study, which seemed to at least in part corroborate their heritage, which was that the people from B'nai Israel came from the Middle East and not from India. But through mitochondrial DNA research, we'll go back and elaborate what that is, but it proved, or it seemed to indicate, that the majority of the initial women of the community were local. Now, once again, that doesn't mean that they didn't convert. It just means that they were local Indian women. And so what I want to explore this week is a much more contemporary issue using mitochondrial DNA, and that is namely, does it carry any weight in the halachic calculus of determining somebody's Jewish identity? So I'm going to try to share the source sheet for those that For those that would like to watch it, let me see if I can put it on. Okay. So the title of the class is From Australia to Sweden, Mitochondrial DNA in Halacha. So mitochondrial DNA, if you want to see in the picture on the bottom of the first page, every human cell has a lot of what we call organelles, a lot of smaller particles in the cell that carry out different aspects of, you know, different functions that the cell needs to continue to live and do what it needs to do. And one of those is called the mitochondria. The mitochondria is responsible in eukaryotic cells, like human cells, for essentially giving energy. It's the power plant of the cell. And unlike all the other parts of the cell, the mitochondria has its own DNA. Now, regular DNA that we find in the cell nucleus is passed down from both the father and the mother. They combine, and a certain part of us comes from our father, and a certain part of us comes from our mother. The DNA in the mitochondria, however, is passed on only from the mother. And so what that means is that anything that we find in a child in the mitochondrial DNA must have been passed down from the mother. And because Jewish identity is matrilineal, you're only Jewish if your mother was Jewish, unless you convert, obviously. If that's the case, then theoretically, if somebody has DNA of a Jewish mother in their mitochondria, then maybe they should also be considered to be Jewish, since it's clear that their parent was Jewish. So this question actually is still being debated in the halachic community in terms of how much credibility and weight mitochondrial DNA evidence can provide. The question that I want to talk about, or the story that I want to talk about this week, happened a few years ago. It was published in sort of a journal or treatise on mitochondrial DNA in Israel, I think about a year and a half ago now. The question was addressed to Rav Usher Weiss. Rav Usher Weiss is a very famous posek, a very famous rabbi in Yerushalayim. He is an expert in many subjects in halacha, especially medical ethics. He's the posek of Shaarei Tzedek Medical Hospital, and he's also the president, so to speak, or like the overseer of a Smicha MD program in Technion Medical School. And this was a question that one of his students, who's a rabbi in his own right, forwarded to him. So a couple of years ago, in Australia, there was a Frum family. One of their sons was no longer keeping Torah and mitzvos, and he married an ostensibly non-Jewish Swedish girl. And he didn't want to have contact with the rest of his family, and, you know, they pretty much did their own thing for a couple of years. At some point, now, just to be clear, his wife, his Swedish wife, was not claiming to be Jewish. Everybody believed that she was just a regular Gentile person. At some point, a story surfaced that her grandmother or great-grandmother, I don't remember the details, some descendant a couple generations earlier may have come from Poland. And so when the family found out about it, they said, hey, maybe she's Jewish. She wouldn't be the first person to escape to a neutral Scandinavian country during World War II. So they suggested, why don't you do a DNA test? And the husband did not want to. He didn't want to have any connection with his family. He didn't want his wife to have any connection with Judaism. But somehow she managed to do a genetic test, which showed that she had a specific genetic sequence in her mitochondrial DNA that is extremely prevalent in Jewish Ashkenazi families. So the way this genetic testing works is there's a procedure called a DNA gel electrophosphoresis, which basically means that if you look in the top picture on the top page of the source sheet, you take the DNA, you put it into this like gel-like solution. And one side is positively charged, one side is negatively charged. And when you turn on an electrical current, the molecules get pulled. And so the bigger molecules get pulled slower, and the smaller molecules get pulled faster, and they sort of stain a sheet of paper. And that's a specific genetic sequence. And so if you match that up with another one, it shows that it's either the same person or they're genetically related. So in 2006, on the first page, you can see sort of an abstract of the study from the University of Chicago, that genetic tests show that 2/5 of Ashkenazi Jews are descended from 4 women. Now, these aren't the 4 matriarchs that we read about in the Torah or in the Haggadah that we sing about, but that's sort of the term that was coined, that the 4 founding mothers lived in Europe about 1,000 years ago, where the ancestors of 2/5 of Ashkenazi Jews came from. And this was a joint study with Technion, Einstein, University of Chicago. Now, again, obviously, the farther back in history you go, the more confounding factors. So it's not, 100% proof. And quite frankly, as believing Jews, we don't need this to prove that we all came from Jewish people, we came from a genetic sequence that seems to be especially prevalent in the Middle East, even though we've been living in Europe for 2,000 years. But it's always nice when we find historical proofs, especially when for many, many hundreds of years, people that are anti-Semitic have claimed that that the Jewish people in Europe were not the Jews from Israel, rather were descendants of the Khazars, Central European community. It's always nice to have these historical proofs as well. But for our purposes, these researchers found a specific haplotype, a specific genetic sequence that is passed down only from the mother, that showed that many, many Jews were descended from the same person. Now, if you go down to the second page, I put the results in a chart. The results of this test showed that 54 out of 1,500 Jews had this specific genetic sequence, which is approximately 3.6%. When you compare that with local Gentiles, that's 7 out of 51,000, which is 0.014%. So that's 300 times more likely for a Jew to have this genetic sequence than a non-Jew to have this genetic sequence. So it's much, much more likely, 300 times more likely for a Jew to have this than a non-Jew. Now, if you do the math, if you compare the Jewish population to the non-Jewish population, what comes out, though, is that you have about 500,000 Jews in the world with this genetic sequence and 100 million Jews and 100 million Gentiles with that specific sequence. So on the one hand, Jews are 300 times more likely to have it, but they only make up about 0.5% of the world's population with that genetic sequence, simply just because there are more Gentiles than Jews. So that statistic, the numbers themselves aren't important, but that statistic is very important for later on. And again, so just to put it more clearly, an individual Jew is much more likely to have this genetic sequence than a Gentile. But if you take the total number of people in the world with it, there are much more Gentiles than Jews with it. So let's just keep that statistic in our minds. And now let's go back to the story. So this Swedish girl, this Swedish woman, had this genetic sequence. And the husband was still adamantly against looking into his wife's Jewish roots. He essentially forbade her and other people that were trying to help reconcile the family, he absolutely forbade them from looking into her heritage any further. And so what the family's rabbi in Australia wanted to know was, since it's essentially impossible for us to verify her Jewish lineage any further because the husband doesn't want to have anything to do with it, can we rely on these genetic results to say that she doesn't need to convert and she's already Jewish? Or no, do we have to wait until we can convince the family to do more research? And so this was the question that was asked to Rav Asher Weiss. Now, the person who asked this to him is a student of Rav Asher Weiss, who published this in a book and is very, very, very into using mitochondrial DNA to provide Jewish lineage. Rav Asher Weiss himself is much more reticent to use it. And what I want to talk about today is essentially his arguments for different legal paradigms that we can use that maybe it can work for. So if you look on the second page, I have a chart of potential legal paradigms for how mitochondrial DNA can be used in halacha. So one is called an umdina. We'll explain all of these in greater detail throughout the class, but just to give a quick explanation, an umdina is what we assume happened. We take something as a given. Rov, which means a majority, and simon, which means a sign. So all of these three concepts are used in various areas of halacha. You can see on the chart that an umdina is used for torts and capital punishment. Majority rov is used for kashrus and for parentage. And signs are used for returning lost objects, as well as for identifying a husband who died for aguna or yibum purposes in order to allow a widow to remarry. So we're going to look at all of these different paradigms and see how they would play out in our case in establishing Jewish identity. So let's now go to the third page and we'll see the first one, umdina, or expected behavior. Now this is used in halacha in pretty much two different cases. The first one, which is much a very, very powerful case, is a Gemara in Sanhedrin about capital punishments. So let's look at source number one on page 3. Tanya, we learned in a Braisa, Amar Reb Shimon ben Shetach. Reb Shimon ben Shetach said, now just historically, Shimon ben Shetach was the head of the Sanhedrin, and he was an extremely important figure in terms of court evolution. He made a lot of different innovations in terms of how the court functions in order to protect the integrity of the court, of the Jewish court, to make it an independent body, free from government influence, free from manipulation by litigants. So he's the one that talks about the judiciary process. And so he said, Era b'nechama, I will see the consolation of Jerusalem, essentially a language of an oath. He swore, Im lo ra'isi echad sheratz achar chaveiro l'churva. I saw one person running after another. Now, chaveiro literally means friend, but as we'll see, he was not a friend. He saw one guy chasing another one into an abandoned building. V'ratzti acharav, and I ran after them. V'ra'isi sayif biyado, and when he got into the building, he didn't get there in time. But when he got in, he saw a person holding a bloody sword. V'damo metaftev, blood was dripping off of the blade. V'harog mefarper, and the person who had been stabbed was essentially in the throes of death. He was actively dying. So it must have happened very recently. But he didn't actually see the murder happen. V'amartilo, and so I told this person who presumably killed the other one, Russia, wicked person, mi hargo lazeh, o ani o ata. There's only two people in the world that could have possibly killed this person, either me or you, and it wasn't me. Aval, ma aeseh, but what can I do? She'ein damcha masur biyadi, because your blood is not in my hands. I can't put you to death for this. Shaharei Amra Torah, because the Torah says in Parshas Shoftim, which talks about judges in courts, Al Pishnayim Edim Yumas Hames, based on the eyewitness testimony of two people, can a person be put to death? And I didn't see you. Hayodeya Machshavos Yipara Meoso Ish. Yipara Meoso. And so, essentially, Shimon ben Shetach cursed him, that the one who knows a person's thoughts, meaning God, should pay you back for what you did. Amru, and so the tradition is, lo zazu misham ad sheba nachash vihikisho vames. And so almost instantaneously, a snake came out of the building's walls or the ground. It bit the murderer and he died. So Shimon ben Shetach's curse came true. There was divine punishment. But what do we see from this Gemara? The Gemara calls this case an umdino de muchach. It is a case where we clearly know what happened. And nevertheless, for capital punishment, there is an explicit pasuk in the Torah. There is an explicit verse that when it comes to capital punishment, we cannot use an umdino. We need to have an eyewitness account. And if we don't, even though we pretty much know for sure what happens, what had happened, the person cannot be put to death. You know, just like we have in that picture. If a kid is holding a baseball bat or a tennis racket, there's a ball and there's a broken window, we know what happened. But if it would be a case of capital punishment, we could not put the person to death. So that's about capital punishment. But now, what about other cases? What about non-capital punishment cases? So another very common instance where this concept of umdina comes up is like in that picture by torts. If you break something or if you hurt something and you need to give financial restitution. So does an umdina work there? If we look in source number 2, there's a Gemara in Bava Basra. Rabbi Acha Amar. So Rabbi Acha said, Gamal ha'ocher ben ha'gmalim. So if a camel, a male camel, is it's rutting, it's at the time of year where camels mate, and you're in this parking lot for camels, sort of a camelot, if you will. And let's say you're walking through, and you see that next to this camel that is in its mating season, you find another one dead right next to it. Biyadua shezehargo. And so it's clear that this rampaging camel killed the other one. And the Gemara goes through this very long process of trying to figure out what the halacha is, but ultimately it says, we know that this camel did it, and so the owner of that camel is liable. Essentially what it says is that in umdina, an instance where we pretty much know what happened, even though we can't give a person capital punishment for it, even though we can't kill somebody, we can make a person financially liable. So for divrei mamonos, for financial matters, we can. In umdina does work. So the person asked Rav Asher Weiss, maybe this genetic testing is such a clear sign, it's 300 times more likely that a Jew has it than a non-Jew. So therefore we should say this is an umdina de muchach. This is a clear case where we know what happened. We know that she came from a Jewish mother. That's what the person argued to Rav Asher Weiss. Rav Asher Weiss had two responses. One was a technical one, which is, well, the Gemara never really tells us what is an umdina de muchach, what is a very, very clear sign versus just a clear sign. So maybe this statistic is not a clear sign, is not clear enough. We don't know. But he says more fundamentally, in umdina, you can't just use it in all cases where you know what happened. He said, what exactly does this argument mean? Let's look at that picture. So you have these two birds, if you will, or two people. This little kid has a tennis racket. There's a broken window and there's a ball and he's standing right next to it. And he says, it wasn't me. Now the umdina there is that he broke it. But what essentially are you saying? You're saying that I know what happened, but it's not that I know what happened. I know what you did. Based on your behavior and your innate tendencies and the evidence, I'm able to judge your behavior. So let's go back to the killing case by Shimon ben Shetach with the guy running, chasing after a person with a knife. And then you come in with a bloody, and you come in and you see somebody standing over a dead body with a bloody knife saying, yeah, I got you. That is not evidence per se, because he could say it wasn't me. Rather, what it does, it's an insight into human behavior that given somebody chasing after somebody else, yelling at them with a raised knife, and when you come in, you see them with a bloody blade and there's a cadaver next to them, we can assume that given all of that circumstantial evidence, human behavior is to have killed the person. Or let's take the Gemara in Bava Basra with the camels and the Camelot. So you had this very aggressive camel standing next to a dead camel. So the halacha says, not that we know what happened per se, because something else might have happened. Rather, given camel tendencies, given certain biological and physiological data that we have that's essentially universal, we can deduce or we can argue that we know what this camel would have done. So Rav Asher Weiss says that these paradigms in the Gemara for an Umdana cannot be used universally. They can only be used when we're trying to understand the subject's behavior, when we're trying to understand human behavior or animal behavior. This case that we're talking about is not a behavioral question. It's a historical question. We're trying to figure out what happened, not what a person did. And so Rav Asher Weiss says that Umdana can only be used to understand what somebody did and not what happened. Therefore, he says, Umdana cannot be a good mechanism for genetic testing. Okay, that's the first paradigm that he says cannot work. Now, let's go to a much more universal concept called rove or majority. So if you look in source number 3, it's at the bottom of the second page. Source number 3 is a pasuk in Mishpatim. It's a verse from Parshas Mishpatim, which also talks about courts. And as we'll see, this pasuk is also talking about the court. It says, Lo sihiyeh acharei rabim lera'os. You should not follow the majority for evil. V'lo sa'aneh al rov lintos. And you should not respond concerning a lawsuit to follow the many to pervert justice. Instead, acharei rabim lahatos, you should only follow the majority to do good. So the Gemara in Chulin in source number 4, it says, Minaha milsa d'amar rabbanon zil basar rov. So the Gemara in Chulin asks, how do we know that we follow the majority? And the Gemara says, well, of course we know. It's from the previous verse that we just read. Dichsiv acharei rabim lahatos. You're supposed to follow the majority. Even though that specific case is talking about a court, nevertheless, our sages understood from there to expand it to cases of majority in all other areas of halacha. But the Gemara qualifies it. And it says, ruba de'isa kamar. This case says, well, if you think about that verse, which is talking about a court, in that case, you have, just make it easy, you have 9 judges saying one thing, and you have 1 judge saying another. So the halacha is you follow those 9 judges. And so the Gemara says we can only extrapolate to a case like that, which is called a ruba de'isa kaman, when all the different factors of the suffix, of the uncertainty, are before you, are in front of you. So the case that the Gemara gives is kigon teisha chanuyos, like 9 stores. So the case is, let's say you find a piece, you're in the meatpacking district, and you find a piece of meat on the street. It's all packaged up, but there's no identifying symbols. And on this block, there are 9 kosher stores and 1 treif store. So all the different pieces of this puzzle are in front of you. There are 9 kosher stores and 1 treif store. So the halacha is you can follow the majority and say it came from one of those nine stores. Or another case that the Gemara says, Sanhedrin. You have 9 judges saying one thing and you have 1 judge saying another thing. You follow the 9 judges. So the Gemara says, Lo kami bayala. And that's not what I'm asking you. We obviously know that. That's what the Torah told us. He come a bayalan, what I'm asking you is ruba de lesa kaman. A rove, a case of majority, where all of those factors, all those pieces of the puzzle are not in front of you. So let's go back to our meat case. So you find a piece of meat in the Diamond District. So there are no butcher shops there. But you know that in this city, there are 9 kosher stores and 1 non-kosher butcher. So the halacha there is might be different. The only case where we know that you can follow the majority is when all of those pieces are in front of you. But when they're not in front of you, the Gemara asks, well, maybe that should be different. And it's an interesting philosophical question as to why it should be different when you can't see it, or versus when you can see all the different factors. But just, you know, a very simple explanation is, well, maybe since they're not in front of you, maybe the likelihood is a lot less. Now you have to contend with the whole world. You know, who says it came from this block? Maybe it came from somewhere else. We don't know. And so the Gemara says it's a halacha l'Moshe Misinai. There's a halacha l'Moshe Misinai that even when you can't see all of the pieces, maybe, nevertheless, we still follow the majority. So if you find a piece of meat in the Diamond District and there are no butchers there, if there are more kosher stores than treif stores, the piece of meat is kosher. So the person, so the rabbi asking Rav Asher Weiss about this girl, he says, well, she has a genetic sequence which is 300 times more likely to be found by a Jew than by a non-Jew. So if that's the case, the person said, this is like a case of Rov de Lesa Kaman. All of the pieces of the puzzle are not right in front of us, right? We can't say, oh, she came from one of 10 people. She could have come from anybody throughout the world. But nevertheless, because it's so much more common in Jews than in non-Jews, we should use the concept of Rov to say that she came from the majority of the people with that genetic sequence, namely Jews. And so Rav Asher Weiss responded by comparing it to another case, which came up about probably about 10 to 15 years ago, about cows and kosher milk. So one of the Rashi Yeshiva in YU is Rav Herschel Schachter. Rav Herschel Schachter is a posek for the OU. He decides a lot of the policies of kashrus for the OU. And in 2007, when this article was published, Rav Belsky from Torah Vidas in Brooklyn, he was also the other head posek of the OU. He also worked together with Rav Schachter, and they dictated the halachic policies for the OU. What they were deciding in 2007 was the kashrus of milk. Now, we all drink milk. You know, assuming that we can drink milk, we believe that regular milk is kosher, especially in America, where there's no concerns, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, about people mixing in milk from non-cows, like pigs or donkeys or whatnot. We can rely on government rules and FDA codes. And so therefore, if you go anywhere in the country and you find regular milk, you can buy it because there's no kashrus problems whatsoever. In 2007, someone raised the possibility that that might not be the case. So if you look in source number 5, this is an article I pulled from the OU's website. It was published in 2007. And so I'll summarize it. You can read it on your own. The halacha is that milk from an animal that will die from a specific wound, it's called a trefa. If an animal has a wound that will make it die within a year, it's treif, you're not allowed to eat it. And in addition, its milk is not kosher either. So if that's the case, then shouldn't we have to wait 12 months from whenever we milk a cow to see if we can drink it? And then we could never drink milk because it would spoil. So the Gemara in Chulin, it says that there is a halachic axiom that uses the concept of rov. Rov behemos kesheros. Most animals are presumed to be kosher. And therefore, when I have a glass of milk, I can assume that this milk came from a kosher cow, because just empirically, the Gemara says, we know that most animals are kosher. Most animals won't die within a year. That may have been true throughout most of the world's history when cows and milk was not commercially produced. In 2007, someone argued that in today's modern world, due to just the commercial reality, that might no longer be the case. So cows on dairy farms are fed a diet that is very heavy in grain, and cows will sometimes suffer from an illness called displaced abomasum. I'm clearly not pronouncing that correctly. but there's a certain disease where essentially someone just posted that video is lost.
I see you coming in fine.
Oh, okay.
Anybody else have a problem?
Okay. All right, well, hopefully we'll get back online for everybody. Anyway, there's this illness where, due to this heavy grain diet, the fourth stomach will become displaced due to built up gas or fluid. It's very dangerous. Cows could die from it. And there are, you know, a lot of ways to deal with the disease. But one of the treatments to help this is to pierce the three walls of the stomach, essentially making a couple of holes to let the gas filter out. Now, it's a debate, but many poskim have questioned this procedure and said that this might make the cow a trefa. This might make the cow die within a year. Now, I don't want to get into all the technicalities and the scientific debate as to whether we can assume that they will die within the year or not. Obviously, if this would kill all the cows, they wouldn't be doing it. But at the very least, there was a great increase in the statistical likelihood that the cow would die if they would puncture its stomach. And so somebody said, well, let's look at the statistics of how many cows have this disease and have this treatment. And so looking at the cows, at least in the New York region, where a lot of our milk comes from, they found out that 1 out of 20 has this disease or has been treated for this disease by puncturing the stomach, which would essentially make 1 out of 20 cows to be non-kosher. Now that presents a very big problem for milk, because we have a rule that at least b'dieved, if something wrong happened and some non-kosher ingredients got mixed into something. So let's say you're making chicken soup and accidentally somebody spills a little bit of milk into it. So you're not allowed to have milk and meat together. But we have a concept in halacha called batel b'shishim, that if the ratio of kosher to non-kosher is greater than 1/60th. If that's the case, then we look at it as if that bad particle or that treif particle does not exist. So let's go to the chicken soup case. If you're cooking chicken soup and a little bit of milk falls in, if there's 60 times the chicken soup than the milk, then if it already happened, you obviously can't do it because you want to put milk in, but if it happened, the soup is still kosher. So what about our milk case? 5%, though, is greater than 1/60th. The way milk is processed is that you milk all the cows, and then from, say, 20, 1,000, 200,000 cows, all that milk is mixed together, and then is put into milk containers. So Rav Schechter said, well, if that's the case, and 5% of our milk is treif, then we should not be able to drink commercial milk. And that's what he does. Rav Schechter does not drink milk in America. He drinks it in Israel, because in Israel they treat the cows much more humanely. They're treated much nicer. This disease is not as prevalent there. But in America, he will not drink milk. Now, if any of you have a bottle of milk in your refrigerator, many of you will notice that it has a hechsher from the OU. It has the OU on it, which means that that the OU did not follow Rav Schechter on this, and Rav Schechter himself does not say that other people need to follow it. It's a personal stringency that he has. But the argument is a very strong argument. How do we deal with this? If one out of 20 cows are not kosher and all of their milk is mixed together, then there's essentially a 5% there's a 5% of every milk container is treif milk. So how are we allowed to drink milk? So Rav Asher Weiss, if you look in source number 6 on page 5, Rav Asher Weiss deals with this question. And again, he gives a very interesting answer. I'll read it to you. He says, "Ula anias daiti, in my humble opinion, kol mehuma hazo, this entire upheaval, this entire uproar, bita'us yisoda, is based on a fundamental error. V'yisod hata'us bama shehechlifo beidin Torah de'acharei rabim lahatos lemada'ei ha-statistika." That the root of this mistake is that the halachic community, essentially Rav Schechter, and the others that agreed with him, is that they have conflated the Torah's principle of following the majority of Rove with statistical science, with the field of statistics. And he says, you know, it might be very easy to say that, especially with a Ruba Delesa Kaman, with the Rove that is not before us. Right, so if you find a piece of meat in the Diamond District and you know it came from the Meatpacking District, and you say that there's a higher probability that it came from a kosher store, you're essentially invoking statistics. You're saying there's a higher statistical likelihood that it came from the kosher store. But Rav Asher Weiss says if you actually look carefully, that's not true. That the laws of Rove do not conform to the laws of statistics. He gives a very fascinating proof. Look at source number 7. There's a Mishnah in Machshirin. Meseches Machshirin talks about the laws of purity and impurity, but it sort of goes on this tangent to talk about a very interesting case, which is very similar to the one that we're talking about with the girl from Sweden. The Mishnah says in source number 7, Matzah batinok mushlach im rov akum. So you find an abandoned child in the middle of a city. If the majority of the city's population are non-Jews, then akum, then the child is a non-Jew. The im rov Yisrael, if the majority are Jews, then Yisrael. Then the abandoned child is a Jew. Mechza al mechza, if it's split down 50-50, then it's a machlokas, then it's a debate. So Rav Asher Weiss says, well, if you would read this Mishnah at first glance, again, it would be statistics. If the majority of people are non-Jewish, we can assume the baby's non-Jewish. But if the majority of the people are Jewish, then you follow the statistics and say that the baby is Jewish. But he says, if you think about it, that's not true. He says, why? Because where did this baby come from? It came from a mother. So why are you counting all the males in the population? The Mishnah should have said not imrov akum, it should have said imrov nashim akum. It should have said if the majority of the women in the city are non-Jews. And then he takes it a step further. He says not all women are capable of having children. Some of them are too young, some of them are too old. So it should be women that are of childbearing age. And then he goes further and he says, well, not all women of childbearing age were pregnant in the last 9 months. So what the Mishnah should have said is that if the majority of pregnant women in the last 9 months are non-Jews, then the baby is non-Jewish. And if the majority of pregnant women in the last 9 months were Jewish, then the baby is Jewish. But the Mishnah does not say that. Instead, the Mishnah says, just look at the majority. And so Rav Asher Weiss says that it is clear that because the Torah says it as a halacha l'Moshe Misinai, it was a tradition passed down from Hashem to Moshe, passed down through all generations, or it's a pasuk in the Torah is not telling you to follow statistics. The Torah is giving us a playbook for how to define reality, not to determine probability. And so just going back to source number 6 for a second, what Rav Asher Weiss says is that let's go back to our case of of kosher cows versus non-kosher cows, right? So we said earlier that rov behemos ksheros, that the majority of animals are kosher. So let's say you have a corral of 10 cows. So it says that the majority of cows are kosher. Okay, but what does that imply? That implies that a minority of them are non-kosher, or that a minority of them could be not kosher. So how are we allowed to eat the entire corral of cows? Statistics would say that we would dictate that 6 of them are kosher and 4 of them are treif, or 7 of them are kosher and 3 of them are treif. Statistics does not say that all 10 of them are kosher. And yet the halachos of rov, that's saying follow the majority, applies to all 10 of them. And we determine that all 10 of them are kosher. And so what Rav Asher Weiss says is that rov, the concept of majority in halacha, is not a statistics, but rather a guidebook that the Torah gave us with its own rules for determining reality. What that means for our milk case is that we look at each cow separately. We look at the question. What is our question? Our question is not whether this container of milk is kosher. Our question is this cow kosher? Is this cow kosher? Well, maybe it is, maybe it's not. But the concept of majority tells us that this cow specifically, the majority of cows are kosher, and so this cow is also kosher. Now, if you add up enough cows together, if you take 1,000 cows, then yes, statistically, one of them is treif. And therefore, if you mix all of their milk, maybe you should say that there's some treif milk. But the rove is not a statistic. It doesn't say that statistically there's treif milk here. Our question was not on the milk. Our question was on the cow. And rove says that each individual cow is kosher. And so now when you mix it together, even though the statistics have changed, the halacha has not changed. And therefore, since all of the milk came from individually kosher cows, therefore the milk is kosher, even though statistically speaking, there's treif milk in that bottle. So now, it's a very strange concept, but to put it succinctly, rove does not mean statistics. Rove means follow the majority to answer the halachic question that you have. So now let's go back to the results from our genetic study on page number 2. I said that there were 2 interesting statistics. Given the results, Jews are 300 times more likely to have that specific genetic sequence, but they only make up 0.5% of the world's population with that genetic sequence, because there are much more Gentiles than Jews. And so Rav Asher Weiss says, even though statistically speaking, a person who is Jewish is much more likely to have this than a non-Jew, says that's not the question. Our question is, where does this person come from? Not, is it a greater likelihood that she's Jewish if she has this genetic sequence? And so he says that, since there are much more non-Jews in the world that we're picking this person out of than Jews, so let's say you have 101 million people in the world with this genetic sequence. Only 500,000 of those are Jews. The other 1.5 million are Gentiles. So even though statistically speaking, it's much more likely for a Jew to have it than a non-Jew, since if you just take line up everybody, your question is picking out one person from that pool, then if that's the case, then the majority of them aren't Jewish. And so we can't say that this girl follows the majority of Jews. We would have to follow the majority of non-Jews and say that the girl is not Jewish. And so therefore he says that rove, simply using rove to answer our halachic question, is not sufficient to determine Jewish identity. Now let's go to the last question, or the last paradigm. The last paradigm is simen, or signs. Now, we use signs in halacha for probably two different areas that are very famous. One is by hashavas aveda, if you lose a lost object. So the way the process works is, let's say I lose my phone. So I lose my phone, and then somebody else finds a phone. They announce it by saying, I found a phone. If somebody lost it, they should give me certain simanim. They should give me certain signs to identify that this phone is theirs. And if they match up, I'll give it to you. I once had that when I was in Israel, learning in Israel for the year. I had a camera and my memory card fell out on the beach near Achziv Beach, in northern Israel near Nahariya. And I only realized it after I was back in yeshiva and I gave up on it. About 5 years later, I was Googling my name on the internet, and somebody posted on a Chabad blog that they had found a memory card and there was a person on there that had the name Tzvi Benov. And so I was able to identify the memory card based on the pictures that were on this memory card, and I was able to get it back. So that's the way that simanim work for Hashavas Aveda. And another instance where it works is by identifying a dead person. This comes up by Aguna a lot. So let's say a husband is going on a long business trip. Back then they didn't have planes, so he goes on a caravan and he never comes back. And a year later, they find a dead body in the desert that matches up with certain signs that the wife gave to describe her husband. His face looked a certain way, his eyes looked a certain way, and it matches up. So the halacha is that if we have one person saying, I found somebody with these signs, we can presume the husband dead and the woman is allowed to remarry. So the person was saying, okay, this woman, okay, maybe you can't use umdana because that's to describe human behavior. Maybe you can't use rove because it's not a statistic, but rather it's just answering our strict halacha question, and then given the results, it's also not a majority of Jews. But maybe we should use simanim. That simanim, just signs, work in halacha to identify a person's identity, or to identify a lost object. So maybe we should be able to identify this person as Jewish. So now let's learn a little bit in the few minutes that we have, let's learn a little bit about simanim, about signs. So the Gemara in Chulin says, Amar Rav Yitzchak Brei de Rav Misharshia. So Rav Yitzchak, the son of Rav Misharshia, said, Teda, you should know, De Elu Asa Betrei Planya, De Hai Simana, Vahai Simana, Katel Nafsha, Lo Katlinan Le. So normally, by capital punishment, two people come in and say, we saw so-and-so kill somebody else. And if they testify and the testimony checks out, the accused gets put to death. But let's say instead of identifying the person, they say, we saw somebody that had certain signs. They looked a certain way. We don't know who it is, but they had red hair. They had a big scar on their face. They had a weird birthmark on their back, just, you know, different signs. If they match up, do we kill them? The Gemara says no. We don't use simanim to put a person to death. Now, okay, you might say, well, it's not something that's unique to capital punishment like umdana is. Maybe we just don't use testimony about signs. Maybe we can't use simanim when testifying. If you testify about somebody, you need to say it was him. Not that he looks like the person that I saw. But that's not true. Because if you look in source number 9, it says that essentially simanim, signs, work if you testify about a husband. If you find a dead body that matches the signs of a person's husband, you testify about that, you can assume that this was a woman's husband and he died, and now the woman is allowed to remarry. And so what does the Gemara say? The Gemara says that signs do work in other areas of halacha. So what's the difference between capital punishment and other areas of halacha. Now, unlike the case of Umdana, where it's a special halacha that the Torah says, or a tradition that was passed down from God to Moshe, we don't have that by simanim, we don't have that by signs. So what's the difference between capital punishment and finding the body of a husband? So if you look in source number 10, the Ritva, one of the commentaries of the Gemara, so he says, V'shema yesh lomar, maybe we could say, D'shanilon ben hechi ditzarech livdok kol hachayim sheba olam shehem rabim. Maybe there's a difference when we need to take into account all living people in the world. And in an instance where you only have to look at a particular time and place in the world, where there are much less people. Now, what that means is that let's take a look at this comic. In this comic, you have a police sketch artist that draws a very generic person that could match many, many different people. And so if you want to say, this crime was perpetrated by somebody with red hair, well, there's a lot of people with red hair. But then you say, okay, he had red hair and a scar in a very, very specific place on his face. So, okay, now that narrows the field of potential suspects down a great deal. But the world has 8 billion people. So just because you found one person that matches up with those signs, even if it's a very unique sign, you know, there's a very good likelihood that there's somebody else in the world that has that too. And so therefore, in source number 11, Rav Asher Weiss says, you can't punish somebody, you can't put somebody to death when just because they look like somebody you saw, because there might be somebody else that looks like that. You can't judge somebody if there's a likelihood that maybe somebody else fits that description. The only time where it works is when you are trying to determine ownership or identity of things that were lost and found. And I think the best way to explain that is that simanim, signs, only work in a given context. If you walk up to somebody and say, hey, you know that cell phone that you have? It has a crack on the back, on the bottom left corner. And he says, yeah. And then I say back, well, that's my phone. And he says, no, it's not. I bought it at the store. The halacha is that he doesn't give me the phone because he's the one that's holding it. So we assume that it's his. The only time that simanim work, the only time that signs work for Hashava Saveda is when he says, I found it, and I say, I lost it. Signs only work in a specific context when the situation makes sense to explain it that way. So, for example, if I lost a phone and somebody else found a phone, so my signs can say, oh, this thing that was lost is mine, and it's not somebody else's that was lost that also happened to have the same signs. Or by a husband. This husband was lost. We found a body that matches the description. And so we don't assume, or we're not concerned about the potential that there was somebody else that died that had that same sign. But just to randomly accuse somebody, well, maybe somebody else did it. There's no lost and found here. There's no identity of somebody lost and found. There's no context with which to use simanim, with which to use signs. So therefore, if Asher Weiss says that when it comes to establishing Jewish lineage, he says that's not a context. This is what all we're trying to do here is to say, okay, this is a sign that the person is Jewish. But if that's the case, well, there are other people in the world that have this sign that aren't Jewish. So it's not that there was somebody lost and found. So let's change it. Let's say a woman says, I had a daughter, you know, I'm Jewish. I had a daughter and she was lost. And then we find a girl who says, oh, I had a mother in such and such a town, in such and such a place. And then they both have the same genetic results. Then DNA might be a good proof or a good siman, a good sign to establish a link. But over here, when the girl herself was not claiming to be Jewish, and nobody in the family claimed to be Jewish, there's no narrative, there's no context with which to utilize simanim, with which to use signs. Because just like there are Jewish people with this genetic sequence, so too, there are non-Jewish people with this genetic sequence. So therefore, Rav Asher Weiss says that simanim would not be a good legal paradigm for establishing Jewish lineage based off of mitochondrial DNA. So therefore, Rav Asher Weiss concluded that based off of this evidence alone, you can't say that she's Jewish. However, he says there's obviously a 300 times more likely chance that she's Jewish than that she's not Jewish. So therefore, he would consider it like a sort of a line of evidence to complement additional data that they would find. I wasn't able to find the responsa, but Rav Moshe Feinstein, he says the way we determine Jewish lineage is essentially accumulation of relevant evidence. So if the family claims that they're Jewish, if they go to a shul, or if they know Hebrew, or if they have some Jewish customs, essentially, if you don't know, if you have questions about a person's Jewish identity and you just can't figure it out, you have to use a certain list of relevant factors. They're not halachic mechanisms, but there are just, you know, sociological and historical proofs. And if there's sufficient evidence, we say that you're Jewish. And if not, then you're not Jewish. And so Rav Asher Weiss says, this alone is not sufficient evidence, but it's sort of, you know, it could be one line on a paper arguing that the person is Jewish. And so what he says is that you need to try to get the girl to do more digging into her family's lineage to try to prove her Jewish identity. So again, just to sum up, mitochondrial DNA is still an evolving topic. We discussed Rav Asher Weiss's opinion, but there are others who say that no, based on either understandings of these paradigms in other ways, or other scientific reasons, they make the argument that mitochondrial DNA should work. And it's still an ongoing debate. But Rav Asher Weiss at least believes that it's not sufficient to determine Jewish identity. Umdina, just assuming what happened is not good because that just explains human behavior. Rove, majority doesn't work because it's not a statistic. And Simon, signs don't work because it only works in a particular narrative to explain something, as opposed to here, where there just is not a narrative where signs would be helpful. So now we've concluded for now our discussion on mitochondrial DNA. The title of the series was Conversions and Covenant. So up until now, we've been talking about Jewish identity, conversions, does someone need to convert? How do we know if they're Jewish or not? Next week, I want to start talking about the covenant part, going back to, so to speak, the first conversions of the Jewish people, what happened at Har Sinai when the Jews left Egypt, what essentially did the Jews do? What changed? What happened to the Jewish people when they became into a nation and stopped being just a people? So right now, if anybody has any questions, please feel free to unmute and ask away. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Was wonderful to see you all. Stay healthy, stay safe, and looking forward to seeing you all next week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care, everyone.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye, everyone. Bye.